funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did it become so overwhelming to live in the present? As more and more devices stream a constant barrage of data about what is happening right now, our experience of time itself is changing, and we get trapped in an overloaded present of real-time information. And while all these technologies were supposed to free our minds up for more important things, my guest today worries that our obsession with the present pushes us into a kind of fretful narcissism and keeps us from engaging in substantive thought about our history or our future. Douglas Rushkoff is a media theorist and digital literacy advocate who teaches at NYU and the New School. His new book is called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Douglas, welcome to Think.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
What is present shock, and how did it become such a pervasive element of our lives?
Well, present shock is really the human response to living in a world where everything happens now. You know, it's this sort of the reaction to being real-time, always on, and simultaneous. You know, why is it happening? Why is now happening now? I think, you know, it's partly because of our digital devices. I mean, you can't underestimate, you know, how big it is to shift from, you know, industrial age sort of clock-based technologies to these new digital ones. But I think it's also a cultural shift that, you know, may have happened anyway, you know, sort of this futurism and leaning forward and speculation and sort of goal orientation of the end of the industrial age, of the end of the 20th century when we were all leaning into the millennium, that kind of flipped once we passed into the year 2000 and got where we are. So I feel like we've gone from sort of being a forward-leaning, future-oriented society, you know, always expanding our great colonialist boundaries and all, to one that sort of stopped and said, well, where are we now? What are my stocks worth now? This is not my beautiful life. You know, it's sort of that moment of a society kind of hitting middle age in a way and saying, where are we?
Well, it's funny that you bring up This Is Not My Beautiful Life, because that's a sort of a song about water flowing, a metaphor, obviously. But you talk about this idea that we used to have of time as being linear and sort of moving in a really predictable progression.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was in Disney World, of all places, a few weeks ago. And yeah, of course, my own book release is on my mind at the time. But this little girl, you know, was looking at one of those signs that says, you know, 90 minutes until Goofy roller coaster, you know, when you're standing on those long lines. And she looked up at her dad and she said, Dad, what's a minute? And I was thinking, you know, in the last century, a minute is like on a round clock, on a clock face. A minute is some fraction of an hour, which is a fraction of a day. You know, the way we think of these units of time is sort of the pi portion that they are of some real event, you know, the Earth, you know, spinning around its axis. Where in a digital age, a minute is not some portion of an hour, which is a portion of a day. You know, it's an absolute duration. It just sort of is. It's, you know, your digital clock is just sits there at 3:23, 3:23, and then bop, it's 3:24, 3:24. You know, you're just paused in one moment or another moment or another moment. And I feel like that's kind of the fundamental shift that's happened as we've gone from a kind of a continuous sweep secondhand way of understanding reality to going to this much more kind of a digital, distinct, discrete movement from one to the other.
It is definitely different from what we used to think of. You know, we would advise people just live in the moment, live in the present and sort of free yourself of worry. And it turns out that living in the present does not take away the anxiety that we have felt probably as long as humans have existed.
Well, it depends which present you live in. You know, in some ways, the digital present, the present of your, you know, Facebook feed and the Twitters, and the SMSs and emails coming in, all the little things that make your smartphone vibrate, you know, those aren't really the present. You know, that's not something that a human being should have to catch up with. You know, that's a whole bunch of data that's trying to catch up with you. You know, you are in the present, But, you know, I look historically, and it really from the beginning of media, from the invention of text through the invention of the printing press and the clock, and now the invention of digital technology, there have been these sort of different ways that people have been distracted from the real moment, that sort of biological, social moment that they're actually in. You know, whether it was, you know, the temple priests who initially, you know, wrote things down and said, don't worry, you know, you'll suffer today, but you will be rescued in the afterlife or at some future time when the Messiah comes. Or the way we were taken out of time with the clock in the industrial age, saying, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. You know, you're not a craftsperson turning out items. You're a worker working on the clock. And, you know, you've got to put in more time, and time is money, and save your money, and it's going to be at interest. You've got to pay it back. Or now, this sort of digital way that we're distracted from the moment that we're in, just by being kind of vibrated into this false now all the time.
Douglas, do you feel like we missed out on an opportunity to create these technologies so that they would match our own sort of biological rhythms? Instead, we are really trying to catch up with something that operates 24 hours a day and doesn't care if it's 3 a.m. or 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah, well, I think we're missing it. I don't think we have to miss it. I'm still really hopeful. You know, when digital technologies first came around in the late 80s or early 90s, to me anyway, I saw, oh my gosh, here we finally have the ability to program our world to our needs rather than just living by the clock. You know, now we can, I remember on the early bulletin board services, people sounded so smart because instead of having to have a real-time conversation, you could download the conversation, you'd look at it, you'd read it, you'd spend hours on your paragraph and then upload it. And everybody, you know, it's ironic to even say this today, but everybody sounded smarter on the internet than they were in real life because they had all the time in the world to think of how they would respond. You know, so, yeah, I think that we can use these technologies. We can use the promise of a digital age to come to recognize some of the innate rhythms in people. I mean, one of the ones that, you know, just had me scratching my head for a long time until I, you know, tried it out myself is, you know, these sort of recent discoveries in biological clocks in humans that, you know, it's not just the day and night that we're responding to, but apparently the lunar cycle as well, which I guess any primitive people, you know, or so-called primitive people, indigenous people know this already. But, you know, I live near a city where we don't even think about the moon or what phase it's in. But it turns out in each week, in each different phase of the moon, a different neurotransmitter in the brain tends to dominate. You know, so what I do in the book is I look at each one of these and say, okay, if acetylcholine dominates on this week, what does that mean for socializing and work? Or if serotonin dominates, or if dopamine dominates, or acetylcholine or norepinephrine, you know, each week, if a different neurotransmitter tends to dominate, then we could schedule different kinds of activities. We'll know what week to party. We'll know what week to work. We'll know what week to meet people. We'll know what week to sort of do analysis. You know, and once you start recognizing those things, you know, the present becomes something you really want to great grasp and experience rather than something you want to run away from.
It's interesting. It's sort of like neurology meets astrology.
In some ways, except I guess, you know, astrology, I think, was sort of thought of more symbolically. I mean, in some ways, it's more neurology meets astronomy, you know, but, you know, most women, I think, know that there's been, I mean, most women, they sort of live much more consciously of these 28-day lunar cycles than men do. But, you know, if it's going to affect one thing, you know, we'd be foolish to think it's not affecting a whole lot of other things as well.
So one of the concerns you have, Douglas, is what you call the collapse of narrative. What's happened to traditional storylines, and what do we lose when we cannot or will not devote the time to absorbing a full narrative?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, in some sense, it's not just that we don't have time to do it, but that we're not living in time. In other words, if we're not living in linear time, then we don't really see things in terms of cause and effect, or, you know, my goals that I'm going to get to. You know, the in a presentist mindset, this sort of digital media environment, if you will, we're much less likely to, you know, follow a charismatic leader who has a dream, you know, and march with him towards a goal. You know, we're going to be much less sort of ends justify the means and much more about what's happening right now. So on the downside, I guess that means it's very hard to organize people in terms of movements. It's very hard to get people interested in a traditional story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. On the other hand, you know, you end up with people who are, in some sense, much more tolerant of a world without endings. You have kids playing fantasy role-playing games who are willing to really play the game, not to win the game, but in order to keep the game going. We have people who can confront problems, say, like global warming, which aren't really problems that you just go and fight a war and win, but they're problems that are sort of much more chronic, where we need to come up with kind of sustainable, ongoing solutions rather than just winning and getting to go to sleep.
Do you think our global efforts against terrorism reflect this new reality?
Yeah, and it's a really interesting one. You know, I mean, I like to, as a parent and a human, I like to think of, well, you know, the war on terrorism is one thing we can win. But yeah, it does feel much more, you know, I don't mean to belittle it, but it feels more like the problem of, like, weeds or, you know, something that you never completely goes away. It's just like, you know, violence. Yeah, we want to move towards a less violent world, but it's certainly not the kind of thing that we can say, you know, like going to the moon. You know, in 7 years, we are going to make sure that there's not a single terrorist left on the planet, that we're going to, you know, wipe it out, like you wipe out polio or something. It seems like a more of a steady state kind of a problem that, yeah, you know, we could beat it. We can beat it back, or we can get to zero terrorism someday as you know, humanity evolves past it. But you can't really fight it in the traditional kind of goal-oriented, we are going to just make this thing happen. It's a subtler approach. You know, it's the kind of thing where a movement, say like the Occupy movement, gives me kind of a faith or a hope that there's other approaches to dealing with problems besides, you know, just declaring our goal and having a campaign and raising a lot of money and going and doing it. That there are people who are willing to say, you know, no, it's actually we need to approach problems in the present, that the behavior that we are having right now is part of the solution, you know, that we're not really willing to wait for a solution, that as Obama promised to some extent when he was running, you know, we are the change we've been waiting for. There are people who are willing to actually, who actually do that and to say, no, I'm going to live the change rather than yearn for the change.
I guess it's also an acknowledgement that nothing is that simple. There's rarely, as much as we long for one, there's rarely a silver bullet.
There's rarely one. I mean, we can't say that there's never one, because sometimes there are, God bless them, you know. But sometimes, you know, sometimes there's not. And it really, it ends up being less about, I'm going to do this in order to make that other thing happen, and much more, I'm going to do this for its own sake. You know, and that it's more like living in a healthy way rather than living in an unhealthy way and then hoping there's a fix for it later.
Douglas Rushkoff is my guest. He's a media theorist and digital literacy advocate who teaches at NYU and the New School. His new book is called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. If you'd like to ask a question or maybe share a story of your own experience of present shock, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with media theorist and digital literacy advocate Douglas Rushkoff. He teaches at NYU and the New School, and he has a new book out called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Douglas, how has storytelling historically assisted us with trying to make sense of the passage of time and the meaning of time?
Well, I guess most simply, you know, stories as we've understood them, regular narrative is always, you know, you create a character, then the character makes a series of choices that, you know, put him or her in some kind of a danger. And, you know, we follow that character vicariously, sort of up the inclined plane of anxiety until, you know, we can't take it anymore. And then the storyteller gives us a solution, you know, whether it's Arnold Schwarzenegger finding a gun or in a better story, a child finding family values or, you know, whatever, there's a solution. And then, you know, that leads to this crisis, climax, and sleep. You know, so it's sort of the Aristotelian arc or the hero's journey is always, you know, through danger, find a solution, and then, So we have this sense of time of leading towards something, of leading towards this climax, this victory or even failure, you know, but at least it ends. You know, and I find in a more presentist society, in the one we're living in now, we sort of lived through postmodernism or something, and now we don't really organize ourselves with those same kinds of stories. We don't really see a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow or a messianic age at the end of our struggle. You know, instead, you know, we're much more in the present. It's much more like a video game, really, where instead of watching some other character go through some journey, we're really in the present making a series of choices, you know, and moving from choice to choice to choice to choice.
And I guess reality TV is an outgrowth of that, too.
Oh, yeah. Reality TV. I mean, it's interesting, though. They kind of edit it back to make it look like stories sometimes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for most of us, it's really... it's just watching a camera that happens to be on. You know, we don't really trust stories. We don't trust the folks who are sitting in a story writing room. We don't know what the agenda is. We get so many of these 30-second stories and commercials anyway, you know, that we tend not to trust the storyteller. We feel like it's somehow, if not even predictable, that it's stacked in some way. Whereas if we're just watching, you know, what we think of as reality TV, it's just like, it's just there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Johnson on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Johnson.
Hi, Chris. First time caller. Great
Welcome.
Show.
Thank you.
I want to ask Dr. Rushkoff what he thinks about companies and marketers today turning into what is called transmedia storytelling, where they have to tell stories through, you know, different channels and different platforms. Is this sort of, undermining stories? What does he think about this issue of co-creation of value to storytelling? Not only are we expected to consume media, but we are expected to add some value to it, like, you know, add something to it. What does he think about that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the sort of transmedia stories or kind of collaborative online, offline, internet, cell phone kind of story creating experiences, you know, on the one hand, you could say, oh, you know, now the consumer is forced in some way to, add value to something, you know, that we're working for free, which is true to some extent. On the other hand, you know, if it's done appropriately, it is a way to involve people in narrative in a totally new way. So that rather than a story being something that comes from some guy sitting in a room with a typewriter, a story is something that we as a community of creative people sort of develop together. You know, it's really about striking that balance. You know, the professional storyteller in this environment is no longer the person who comes up with the plot. You know, the professional storyteller in this environment is someone who comes up really with the rules of engagement, you know, and that's an interesting place for the storyteller to go.
So we may be empowering more people to sort of have a voice and express a voice in this kind of storytelling. On the other hand, you know, there are the ever-present questions about who and what is worth paying attention to when sort of bona fide experts and noisy distractions are competing for our attention on the same platform.
Right. And when it's really hard to distinguish one thing from the other. I mean, you know, on the one hand, I celebrate, you know, the proliferation of things like blogs and podcasts and all the, you know, user-generated media out there, you know, that we are our own authorities. On the other hand, there's a tendency to devalue people who have really studied in a particular field. You know, that every blog sort of looks about the same, and they're all just commenting on something they've read on Huffington Post, maybe, that may or may not be real anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go to colleges where a lot of kids are asking me, well, why should you be paid for your journalism and I'm not paid for mine? You know, and I don't know about paying me, but certainly we want to pay, you know, trained political analysts to look at what's being said and to tell us what's true about it and what's not. You know, what people don't realize often is there's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to cover up, you know, the truth, whether it's by corporations or governments or whoever. You know, if we can't spend a few hundred bucks on a journalist to actually sit for a week with something and try to figure out what's going on, then we're going to have no idea what's happening.
Do you think the ability to make that sort of line of demarcation between online experience and what you and I might call real experience is a generational thing?
I guess to some extent. I mean, the thing that would make it generational is that, you know, kids who are raised in a world where, you know, Facebook already exists, they don't look at Facebook as an invention, you know. They kind of accept it at face value. You know, so they'll look at Facebook and say, oh, well, there's this utility that's here to help me make friends. Whereas I feel like most adults are a bit more aware that, you know, Facebook isn't there to help you make friends. Right. Facebook is there to, you know, to exploit your social graft or to sell, you know, information about you to marketers and to do predictive analysis on your consumer trends. So on the one hand, young people are less threatened by it, which is good. On the other hand, they're less threatened by it, which is bad. You know, you kind of want them, you want them to see that there are alternatives, you know, that we make a choice when we go online. So on the one hand, yes, it's much more integrated for them. On the other hand, it's very easy for them to lose track of, you know, what does physical reality mean? What does it mean to look in somebody's eyes? What does it mean to really gain rapport? You know, 94% of human communication happens nonverbally. And that nonverbal communication only really happens in real time and space with other human beings. And not that we have to say, oh, the net is bad or anything like that, which I wouldn't. I think the net is powerful, but it's powerful for certain kinds of things. And I think that real life face-to-face interaction is irreplaceable for other kinds of interactions.
I'm really fascinated by this concept that our technology, in effect, allows us to be in multiple places at once, which you call digiphrenia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot of people talk about information overload. And I've even been getting some emails saying, oh, you know, this is another book about information overload. It's like, well, no, it's actually not. I've never been worried about information overload. I mean, too much. I just turn it off or don't read it. I mean, I can read so much in a day, and I don't really worry about what I don't read. But I do have a weird feeling online sometimes. And what I've pegged it to is what I'm calling digiphrenia, which is the idea that there's more than one of me sort of simultaneously operating online, you know, all at the same time. There's my Facebook profile. There's my Twitter feed. There's my email inbox. There are all these different Douglas Rushkoffs out there acting. You know, they're actually acting simultaneously. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook could be using my face in a sponsored story, or your face, or any of our, someone who's liked us, you know, their face in something while we're offline asleep. You know, so that there are these sort of different people. There's different digital selves. You know, digital technology is very, very good at making copies, but human beings are not really copied that well. It's hard to maintain a sense of coherence when you don't know what it is that you're doing, even in a symbolic world. So, yeah, I call that digiphrenia. It's this this sense of all these choices happening, some of which are in our control and some of which seem to just kind of happen without us.
And I guess there's also this sense that you can't completely know someone unless you have experienced all of those simultaneous actors. I guess you can't do it simultaneously, but in sequence.
Well, right. I mean, I luckily tend to know people by having met them, mm-hmm. you know, or even just like now we're talking. This on the one hand, this would be considered high tech 100 years ago, but at least we hear each other's voices yeah. and the quality of that, you know, where this is by modern standards, this is an intimate experience because we have all these other things to go on. And there's all of these, I guess what I don't want us to miss out on is the so many instinctual or embedded sort of nuances in how we know how to perceive each other that have evolved over thousands and thousands of years. And we have access to so few of them when we're just trying to judge each other through these sort of digital representations. So I'm so happy for people to use digital representations for things that are like numbers. Like this is my checking account. This is my my portfolio. You know, here's the books I've read. But it's not really the way we as human beings engage with one another in real time, just in digital time, really.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. Douglas, I met you a number of years ago. You were at UT Arlington speaking.
All right.
Yes. I'm interested, I missed the first few minutes of this, but I wanted to bring up an essay that I refer to regularly, Leotard's The Postmodern Condition, a report mm-hmm. on knowledge. The kernel of that I find most interesting is that he privileges the storyteller, that cultures traditionally have done that. Yet what I hear you saying is that everybody's talking. Nobody's listening. The storyteller, who's really good and above everything, may be heard, but there are a lot of potential really sound voices that just can't be heard in all of this fray. How do you respond? How do you hear the voices that you think need to be heard? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean this in a hopeful way. But I start to wonder how important is it to be heard? You know, we all want to get up on a soapbox and be heard and get our message out. I mean, and I've been, you know, privileged and lucky enough to get heard, right? I get to write books that people read or go on the radio right now and people hear. But I think we're moving from, and this sounds kind of heady, so I'm sorry for that, but I think we're moving from a kind of broadcast, amplified way of being heard to a much more resonant, kind of a subtle way of listening and speaking at the same time, that it doesn't have to be this cacophony. It's only a cacophony when we want, you know, a sort of a disproportionate amount of attention, you know, pay attention to me now. This is the message that matters. Look at my banner ad, listen to my podcast, come, come, come. And it's very different when you're in a scaled community of people, which is really where we're going to have to go. You know, if we're going to have a world with, you know, 6 billion people who all have expressions and insights, it's going to have to become less important to be listened to. And it's going to become more important to be able to kind of resonate with a collective story, with a collective sense or sensibility.
What does all of this information do to our ability to detect patterns among so much digital information?
Well, it's funny. You know, some people get a little nuts with it. You know, when you don't have a story to understand the world you live in, what you tend to do is try to make sense of things in the present tense. You tend to try to make sense of things by kind of looking at a snapshot of where things are and then drawing connections between things, which, you know, can lead you down some pretty strange alleys of you know, kind of conspiratorial, paranoid thinking. You know, I call it fractal noia because you know, fractals are sort of these great tools we use to, they're these visual maps that we use to make sense of chaotic situations, to sort of parse the screeching sound of a microphone feeding back into its speaker. But it's very tempting to just draw equivalencies between things that really aren't equivalent. So what I'm suggesting people do is sort of learn to do a pattern recognition or a kind of a softer form of lateral thinking where you understand things more by drawing comparisons between different areas, not equivalencies, but saying, huh, this is kind of like this, is kind of like that. And that's a way of understanding or resonating with a kind of a truth without saying, oh, this is absolutely like that, you know, so that you can see the sort of the patterns underlying politics or culture or science without drawing such hard lines that one thing has to truly be the reason for something else.
And I guess that kind of thinking is really facilitated by a good working knowledge of science and of history.
Well, right. It certainly helps. You know, it certainly helps to, rather than just moving randomly, randomly through things. You know, and it's also to understand that science is a model. You know, that the looser understanding you have of science, the more easy it is, in some sense, to depend on its insights, because you don't look at them as kind of sacred truths that you need in order to exist, but as working premises that function until they're replaced.
Douglas Rushkoff is with us. He is a media theorist and digital literacy advocate who teaches at NYU and the New School. His new book is called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. If you'd like to ask a question or share an experience of your own, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with media theorist and digital literacy advocate Douglas Rushkoff. He teaches at the New School and NYU, and he's the author of the new book Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Douglas, this has already sort of been alluded to in this conversation, but talk, if you would, about this term you coin, overwinding, and the way that it relates to our concept of time and information and sort of structure.
Well, overwinding is sort of what we do when we try to fit these big, massive timescales into really short, kind of now-based moments. I mean, the easiest one to get would be, say, what happens on Wall Street now, where people, rather than investing in a stock and hoping it goes up over time, they want to squish the entire investment lifetime of a stock or an investment into one moment. You know, so they buy. Remember the day we had the IPO for Facebook stock, and people all bought it at 9 a.m, and then at like 9:15, they're all upset that the stock hadn't gone up, and they start selling it, and as if somehow they're supposed to make money on the trade rather than through the investment. But then you see, you know, now we have derivatives markets where, you are supposed to make money on the trade. You know, you buy a derivative and you're hoping, or a future, or a future of a future, or a derivative of a derivative, which is basically just a way of buying a stock over time, which is a derivative, or a derivative over time, which is kind of a derivative of a derivative. Or now you have, you know, ultra-fast trading programs that can literally trade in your future. You know, you try to buy a share of AT&T using E-Trade or Charles Schwab. Goldman Sachs is watching that trade, and they trade based on that trade before your trade actually even happens. You know, without even predicting what you're going to do, they see you doing it as if you're living in their past and they're living in your future. So overwinding is when we take all of these sort of long-term effects and try to push them together into one moment. Or it's funny that I got the idea for that chapter when I was watching the Housewives of Orange County on TV. And I saw these women who, you know, their faces are just Botoxed into like this approximation of what they look like when they were maybe 29, right, as if that's the ideal age. So they've compressed their whole lives into this one little 29-year-old moment that they want to keep alive indefinitely, right? But when they're actually sitting with each other, their faces are so paralyzed in that sort of Botox smile that they're not available to the actual moment that they're in. Mm. And they have these awful misunderstandings and are fighting all the time. You know, it's like one of them says, oh, my daughter, you know, is going in to be tested for cancer. And the other one, through that weird smile, says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And the first one says, oh, she doesn't really care. I thought she was lying. She can't indicate what she's feeling because in order to preserve that moment of being 29, she's made herself unavailable to the moment that she's actually living in. Hmm. So that's that sort of overwinding where your mainspring is just wound so tight that you can't really be available to where you are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Rhonda in Plano. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi, thank you. I was wanting to comment on the fact that when I wanted to increase my digital presence, let's say I was late to the party for Facebook, and I love Twitter at first, but I was told that in order to do that, you know, you need to get on Facebook, so I did. And coming late to the party, I was able to look at all the people that had, you know, 20,000 likes, and of course, I was just starting out, and I knew what my purpose was to have people to engage and me to engage with them authentically, but because you're stressed with the fact that you need to keep up, you have to always be posting and getting more comments. But once I really realized, you know, and started to meet with the people that had the 20,000 likes or the 15,000 likes, I realized that they basically had cheated their way to having those, at least the people that I was interacting with. So I think a lot of the stress that we're under is false stress because we're trying to keep up with something that really doesn't exist, because I have just experienced that I would rather have the interaction and the conversation, if you will, with people who are authentically interested in what I have to say, as opposed to someone who has paid a company or even a robot, so to speak, to just go in and click the like button. Because as I've looked at the numbers over the last year, I see from a percentage point I have as much, if not more, interaction with my 188 likes as opposed to someone who has over 20,000 likes, because I've got actual relationships going on with people that, you know, comment with what I've actually posted.
What do you think? Thank you very much for your call, Rhonda. What do you think about all that, Douglas?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. What she's describing really is the difference between using these technologies the way, you know, the corporation behind them might want us to use them, and using them in ways that are beneficial to us as people and workers and consumers and everything. You know, so, you know, yes, the false and silly way to use Facebook is in order to collect more and more, higher and higher numbers of friends or likes or this or that. You know, that's a bizarre goal. It's one that helps the company, right? They want us to pursue likes. They want us to get more tweets out or whatever it is. They want, you know, time is money and faster and more is better. But, you know, if we can look at these technologies instead and think, well, what do I actually want from this? You know, then we're not obligated to use them the way the companies seem to want us to, but we can use them in ways that support, you know, what it is that we actually want to get done. You know, it's just, it's, it's so hard for people to take authority over their time in that way, to not feel compelled to, oh, I have to answer my email every hour. I've got to check this thing. I've got to do that. I've got to do that. No, you don't have to, right? So I'm not saying the technology is bad. You have to put it away and get rid of it. What I'm saying is it's yours. You own it. You and you own the way that you are going to engage with it. And the minute you do that, the minute even you take something as simple as email and say, you know, I'm not going to answer my email until evening, right? I'm going to wait. You'll just be so surprised how much less email you'll get. You know, because people learn to solve problems. You ever get one of those urgent problems in the morning and you couldn't get to your email in time and you see that the person found someone else and solved it in a couple of hours anyway without your help? You know, it's not the technology that's the problem. It's the people on the other end of the technology who have created these false expectations on us, and we who've created these false expectations on ourselves about how we're supposed to use it. You know, once we liberate from that, then all of these technologies are really our friends.
That's a really interesting point because, you know, a lot of companies in particular are admirably trying to be more transparent. But then internally, there are cultures in some workplaces that essentially require grown adults to report on everything that happens to them during their workday, which ultimately just wastes a lot of everybody's time.
Yeah, it's really it's very infantilizing, too. You know, again, though, what I think what's happening here is that we're taking the values of the industrial age, which is about employment, right, and working by the hour and being accountable to your boss, those values, and we're transferring them into the digital age. You know, whereas the promise of the digital age, remember, we're all supposed to be able to work from home in our underpants in our own time. You know, and we see the beginnings of that, right, on Etsy, where people make stuff and then just trade it with other people directly. We see the beginnings of that in local currencies and time banks. We see that in Square, which you can, you know, just pop on your phone and then start taking credit card transactions from other people. What about when we start using Square and all of these technologies to do local credit transactions where we're not even involving central currency or not even involving the central bank? You know, that's the promise of these technologies. And I don't think it's that far off if we're able to see them as something genuinely new rather than just as a way of reinforcing or somehow extending these obsolete expansionist industrial age models.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Robert in Fort Worth. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, my question or observation based on your guest's really interesting thesis and all of his work is that I think it really goes back to his example of the digital clock face versus the conventional clock face and the transition between events. In the digital context, it happened instantly. In the conventional clock face, it's a very sort of kinetic, tangible, physical transition. Anyway, that's my observation. And
thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did a talk for the South by Southwest conference where I put a digital clock on one side of the screen and an analog clock on the other. And I basically said, you know, we are moving from this analog clock to that digital one. And I talked about all the different ways in which that changes how we experience life. I mean, it's what McLuhan would call living in a different, you know, media environment. So we're living in a digital media environment. It's one that's moving sequentially from thing to thing to thing, choice to choice, point to point. And each point is a kind of a pulse or a stillness, whereas the analog world that we lived in before was circular. You know, each moment it's like, okay, it's just 301. We're at the beginning of 301, and we watch the second hand move down to the quarter, down to the half, and it's like, oh, we're halfway done with that minute. We're going to get, now we're approaching this new minute. We're almost at this new minute. Yay, we've hit the new minute. You know, you don't have any of that sensibility when you're in a purely digital media environment.
I mean, by its definition, shock is sort of temporally limited, right? I mean, you can't stay shocked about anything forever. You can be upset, you can be sad, you can be excited, you can be mournful. Do you think, I mean, are you willing to sort of put a limit on how long we will be stuck in this place we are right now?
Well, I think present shock, I guess, is what happens as we transition from a future-oriented society to a present-oriented one. And I would think that most of us, you know, get over this within, as individuals, you know, within a decade or so. As a culture and an economy, it's going to be tricky, right? Because right now, you know, the dollar is in present shock. That's literally what's wrong with the economy. We have an interest-bearing currency, and a currency that depends on the expansion of the economy in order for it to work. And we've reached the limits of our planet. We've reached the limits of colonialism. We've reached certain limits of expansion. So it's going to be, I think that the really interesting part is going to be, how do we kind of transition ourselves from a future-oriented, growth-based, debt-based economy into a much more steady-state, transactional economy that's more consonant with a digital reality.
We're at the end of the hour. We haven't really talked about this, but it was so interesting. You talk in the book about the reasons people these days tend to be drawn to, like, apocalyptic narratives. Can you talk about how that relates to all this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I joke about it a lot in the book. I mean, it's some of my the most fun stuff is, you know, basically the idea that it's easier for people to imagine, you know, a zombie apocalypse 10 years from now than it is for them to imagine what life is going to be like next month, you know? And I think it's partly when you live in a presentist world, when you live in a reality that doesn't have clearly defined endpoints anymore, it doesn't really have cultural goals, we'd kind of rather have some story through which the present can just end, some conclusion, some relief from the anxiety of existence. And we'd almost, in some ways, rather see a bad ending than no ending at all. And at least the zombie apocalypse is simple, right? There's no more Twitter. There's nothing vibrating in your pocket. You just sit on top of a hill with your family and shoot the zombies as they come. You know, and on some level, it's almost refreshingly simplified the way we used to imagine Y2K crashing all the computers or, you know, getting to go back to the land. It's a pleasing vision on a certain level.
Yeah, suddenly the only information you're taking in is what is happening in your physical present.
Right, and at least zombies move slow, right?
Do you have a plan for the zombie apocalypse?
No. I don't think we'll have a zombie. I never understood the zombies, actually. That how do you get, if zombies kill you and eat you, then how do they get more zombies?
Yeah, I don't know. It is kind of a limiting proposition. I don't know. Thankfully, I haven't had to deal with it on a firsthand basis. Douglas Rushkoff is a media theorist and digital literacy advocate who teaches at NYU and the New School. His new book is called Present Shock: When Everything Happens Now. Douglas, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download that podcast and also learn more about the show at kera.org/think. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And of course, you can email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.